Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
If you are just tuning in, we encourage you to go back and listen from episode one. This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised. Previously on Direct Appeal.
I know when I saw my daughter, there was nothing in the car.
My mother suggested Delaware, so that's what I did that morning. Of course, the cell phone records would have established that alibi, but they somehow managed to get my husband's cell phone tower records and not mine.
What they ended up getting was web browser history.
Undetectable poison, how to commit murder, having to purchase guns illegally. Of course, it looks horrendous.
One of the hardest things to do is actually being able to put somebody physically at the keyboard. It could have been and still could be done.
The searches around these problematic searches, a gambling website, Bill's retirement account, and the state's contention was with me. I had done that to cover my tracks, to look up things that I could have looked up in a book on my desk at work untraceably.
This is episode 9, Garbage Science. Okay, Amy, last time we ended on the damning internet searches on the Maguire's home computer. So this last piece of evidence relates to Melanie supposedly dismembering Bill's body and then wrapping his body up. So they found his body, you know, the body parts in garbage bags, wrapped in blankets, in the suitcases that they retrieved from the Chesapeake Bay area. What had happened was at some point, Melanie had given away Bill's stuff. And I think we are definitely going to talk about that. But let's just say that she gave away some bags of his stuff.
When was this?
So she gave away his stuff pretty quickly, maybe a couple weeks, maybe 3 or 4 weeks after he left.
Because at that point...
Well, let's argue it two ways. At that point, either she is getting rid of a shit because she's killed him and she knows it,
yeah.
Or she's a woman scorn. F you. I'm burning your stuff on the lawn and giving it all away. She explains it that, you know, screw him. He didn't come back for his stuff. I'm moving on with my life. I'm getting rid of it. So she gives it to a friend of hers. She gives it to her friend. It was Celine, I think, her cousin.
Okay.
And she gives him a lot of clothes in all of these garbage bags. And through the course of their interviews and investigation, the police find out that there are all these belongings that Melanie has given to this guy, and they ask if they can have the bags. So now what the police have is the garbage bags that Bill's body was found in,
mm-hmm.
and garbage bags that came directly from Melanie's home. And what they're looking for is, are they a match? Are these the same bags? The prosecution is really excited about this. They think, you know, they're going to test it, and they think that they are going to be a match. So they
Is that a real science? I know you're going to get into it, but is this a form of real science to compare plastics here?
Well, it is. I mean, there's tool mark analysis, and there's also polymers, which are plastics. So yeah, there's chemistry here.
You could tell if it's from like the same lot, or so to speak.
Well, hold that question. Okay. Tell me what you think at the end. So the prosecution retains an expert by the name of Frank Ruiz.
I'm a material scientist. I've worked in the plastics industry now for 39 years. I work primarily in product development and commercialization. I guess you could say I'm an inventor. I develop new products for the plastics industry and then help get them introduced and operating in the market. I was hired to help them analyze two specimens of trash bags that they had collected as evidence during the trial. They had bags that contained victims' parts, and then they had another group of bags that they had seized. They were asking me to compare the two, contrast the two, see if they had any kind of a match to them. You know, they had seen what I had done before. Basically, we had been able to show that the raw materials of bags were very similar, that, you know, there was a certain pattern of lines on the bags that could be matched together, and the composition of the bags and the style of the bags was identical. So they asked me if I could do this same work for them. So we applied several different types of tests to the bags to see how similar they were. Because we're doing scientific testing. We're doing some analytical chemistry. And I know that sitting on a jury are not 12 analytical chemists. So the first thing you have to do is give a very elementary lesson in analytical chemistry. So I was nervous about that because I had to be Professor Frank, and I'm not a professor like you. But I was Professor Frank, explained what each of the tests was measuring, what was involved, and then just showed them samples of the bag that the victim was in. And in this case, they had found bags that appeared similar in the suspect's residence.
So Frank had testified previously at two other criminal trials, which I believe is how one of the investigators found him, and one of them was
a murder trial. Was a prosecutor expert?
He was for the prosecution, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. And he's just explaining that he had done some work in this area before. They contacted him. They provided him with these specimens. They wanted to know, can you tell us whether or not these bags are a match? So he now has to run a bunch of tests on these bags.
Okay.
And so he's going to talk about the tests that he ran and the conclusions he came to.
Well, there's first, the physical testing that we do. We look at the thickness and the size. We look at the seal design. In this case, they were formed from a single tube of plastic. These are flat bags. So that's the other thing. We look at the bag design. Is it a flat bag? Is it another type called a star seal? There's different designs. So you look at the seal. So you go, okay, how is the seal made the same? In this case, all the physical characteristics of the bags match. The next thing is you look at the film itself. Okay. If you hold up a trash bag, even the black ones that you get in the supermarket, they're thin enough so you can see through. And the first thing you will see on most trash bags is a number of lines and stripes and a bunch of inhomogeneity. That's because a lot of these bags, they're using a lot of recycled plastic, which is good. But the problem is sometimes that recycled plastic has a problem mixing and dispersing with the virgin plastic. So you wind up with a series of lines and patterns in the film. The other thing that happens is, like I said, the plastic comes out of this ring-shaped die, a ring-shaped orifice. And over time, for lack of a better word, junk and burnt material builds up on those lips of that die, right is where the plastic comes out. Because the plastic hits the air, it tends to burn. And over time, the burnt plastic will build up along the lip of the die. And that will form lines. It's almost like rifling on a bullet. It's rifling in a way because if you can match bags that are produced very close to each other, because these patterns of lines won't change very quickly, but they will change over time as more and more material builds up. Like, you get this pattern, but it changes. So if the pattern's very close, you could argue it's like these bags had to be made close to each other, because over time, this pattern is only going to get worse, or it's going to change as another lump builds up in the die and starts to cause another defect. The changes could start to happen within 30 minutes. We went to the physical test and saw, okay, all these bags, they match, so it's worth going and start to doing the analytical testing because that gets more involved.
So just briefly, because this is dense and it gets complicated, what he's saying is, we're doing the visual testing first. These are the physical tests. Do they look the same? Are there matching patterns? Next, what he's going to talk about, though, is more of the analytical test, and this is the chemical makeup of the bags. So, are they made of the same thing? Just because they look the same doesn't mean they are actually made of the same thing.
There are several tests we did. The first one is called differential scanning calorimetry. It basically works like this. Plastics, even polyethylene, have crystals in them. They're like sugar crystals, except they're very tiny. And these crystal structures differ between plastics, and they can also differ on the way the film was blown. And this instrument, differential scanning calorimetry, or we call it DSC for short, it measures the flow of heat in and out of a sample. So you take the sample and you heat it through its melting point, and you will observe one or more peaks at several different temperatures. So it's like, okay, let's see if these have the same DSC melting point, which would be another indication they're using the same type of raw material. So we did that on all 10 bags, and all 10 DSCs were a match. So they're all, that's one indication that they are all made from the same material. The other test we did is called infrared spectroscopy. And this is, you do that test by shining a beam of infrared light through the sample and seeing where it absorbs the light. And they're measuring the number, not only the presence of these atoms or bonds between these atoms, but the relative frequency of them. So that's another thing we look at to see, okay, is it the same basic molecular structure, the same basic morphology, I guess basic structures inside there, because it's structure related. It also tends, that technique will also pick up additives, various additives in the film, such as the additive they put in the film to make it feel slippery. So we ran this test, again, on all 10 bags, and all of these infrared scans came back the same. So that says, okay, not only is it the structure is the same, but the additive levels, whatever additives in there, are also in the same levels. We did one more, what's called called loss in ignition. This is where you take the sample and put it in an oven at 600 degrees Fahrenheit and burn off, literally just burn off the polyethylene. For a bag, there's always a certain amount of mineral left, material that won't burn. So they add talc, you know, it's a type of mineral, same thing they use for baby powder, except a different grade. They'll use calcium carbonate, which is ground limestone, something they put in there to roughen the surface just slightly so that the bags don't, the film doesn't stick together and you can open the bag. We found that they all contain the same level of anti-block.
That last test he refers to is also referred to as an ash test.
All right, I have two major points here.
Okay.
My first one is, this means nothing to me if we don't know how many other bags share that characteristic, right? What if it's every bag that was shipped to the East Coast between the years of 2000 and 2004 would have matched?
Great point.
It means nothing to me, first of all. Second of all, with all due respect to the scientific field, what is the validity of the science? Using big words does not mean a science is valid. I think of junk science, bite mark analysis, fingerprint comparison. How many people have been wrongfully convicted on the basis of science that sounds really fancy, but at the end of the day, it's not valid?
Well, I think you have to break it down by test. The first test that he was talking, the first set of tests, there's two different ones. Remember I said there's kind of like the observational ones about the striations and the dye lines. I think that is, as I understand it from someone else, that's more of a subjective science.
That's what it sounded
like. So that part, or it could possibly, from what I've learned, could be subjective. The second set of tests, though, that he's talking about, or the second set of tests he's talking about, the analytical ones, those are, I mean, there's definitely real science behind this. This is chemistry. This is what are the bags made of.
Okay.
And the tests that he talked about are very standard tests from what I understand in making these determinations. However, that being said, he did three analytical tests, right? He said that he did these hard words, right? The differential scanning calorimetry test, which I have trouble with, the infrared spectroscopy. I can't say it.
I know what you mean. That's okay.
The IS test. Eventually, I'll get it right. He said it right. I'm going to try it again. The infrared spectroscopy.
Ha. Beautiful.
And then the third one was the ash test. So these are the three analytical tests that he does. And we just want to keep those on the mind because the prosecution has this expert, but the defense also has an expert who's going to address these tests and her opinions about them as well.
Do you know what would have also helped for me?
What?
If we just took a random black garbage bag out of someone's kitchen cabinet and compared it to the other two. Just like, I'm just curious, how many bags share these?
Right. So we did. James and I looked at some of the tests.
But you can't do the analytic tests.
No, but you were just saying for this on site.
No, I'm saying if that, because they did all of those scientific tests. They looked at the one that had the victim's remains.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at the ones that had the clothes in it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't look at a third one, like almost like a control group,
a control group. Gotcha. Yeah. So that's true.
Yeah.
And one of the questions I asked him, did you hear me? You didn't really hear me ask him, but he said, well, no, that's not really a unique finding.
Okay.
He did say at one point, some of these findings aren't unique because these were black contractor bags.
So they would all share that.
They're going to share a lot of them. One of the things he says is unique is that he could tell by the patterns that they came off the same production line and they were made very quickly within each other. Like they were made within 30 minutes.
Okay, well, that's different.
That is different. But could he say that or not? Are we sure that that's the truth
exactly.
or not?
He might be. It's almost like serology mistakes when people will say only one in 5 million males can share this type of makeup.
Right.
And then it turns out it's, you know, the numbers are quite different.
Right.
Also, I'm wondering if being in the water would change the chemical makeup at all of garbage bags or...
I don't know.
Yeah.
Is the answer.
Okay.
It's a good question,
I don't
know.
Yeah. Okay. I'm excited to hear what the defense is.
Yeah. I mean, it would also probably help us if we had like a crash course in polymers. I interviewed him for a while. I spoke with him and then I interviewed the defense expert. But before we get there, let's just hear, what are his final conclusions? What is, you know, after doing all these tests, and what does he actually conclude?
Oh, 99%, 99 plus. I mean, you can never be totally certain of anything, but 99%. It's like going down a checklist. Does this match? Yes. Are they the same gauge? Yes. Are they the same design? Yes. Same seal design? Yes. Then in the end, and this was the argument in all cases, you can't say for sure that this bag came out of the same box. But you can say, what are the odds are that it didn't? Okay, it comes down to a matter of odds. Okay, I let the jury decide for themselves. What are the odds that Melanie McGuire and the real killer went and got bags from certainly the same pallet coming out of the bag supplier? And the real killer, how did they get those same bags? Is it maybe it was somebody she worked with? You know, I guess the police exclude them. We said, well, if these are industrial institutional bags, like say someone in a restaurant committed a crime and they grabbed the bag. Suppose they didn't just pick one of the common ones. They picked the weird one. They picked one, you know, the 44 by 56, and they used one of those. It's like, there are not too many people make a 44-56 and sell it in institutional market. Unless somebody, you know, else was able to get to that same pallet, or maybe half a pallet of bags, who else could have had that? You have to be the judge as to whether someone else could have accessed those same bags from another facility and committed this crime. These bags were made, you know, within a few hours of each other, a maximum of several hours apart because of the dye pattern, the maximum, because it would have changed within a few hours.
And that's his conclusion.
They're
a match, 99.9% sure is what he said.
Just to play devil's advocate, is it possible that since Bill packed up and left the house, that he brought some garbage bags with him, or he had these garbage bags in his car, just like it's possible that someone turned his own gun on him?
Amy loves to steal my thunder, I just want to say,
for the
record. Oh,
why are we going to say that? We just both, good minds think alike.
I know. So one of the things I would bring up at the end would be, is this all for nothing? Is this all a moot point? Melanie says, we were moving. Mm-hmm. We got garbage bags. I had some in my car. We had some in the house. And Bill had some in his car.
Oh, there you go.
And I actually saw on a report somewhere that they did recover some garbage bags from Bill's car.
And did they match these other garbage bags?
We don't know.
We should know.
But so this is a great point. I mean, even if you accept all of this and whatnot, it's the same
still
argument.
Not proving anything.
About the gun, right? Isn't it possible that, great, Bill had, you know, suitcases in his car because they got an argument. He stormed out. He's got the contractor bags. He takes his gun and he's all heated up, right? He's riled up. He's pissed. He leaves. He goes somewhere and perhaps he's in some type of altercation with someone. So,
and someone uses his own stuff.
His own.
Right.
Wow. How convenient. This guy has.
He already has garbage bags, a suitcase.
He's got everything I need in the car. This is terrific. So,
including a sedative, right?
Including a sedative. So this is the prosecution's expert. I'm going to say Frank is a good expert here. He has a lot of experience and he seems to have run, you know, the right tests. And let me also say that he explains things in a way that he takes difficult concepts and he makes them easier for people. So he's saying he played professor. I thought he played professor well.
Yeah.
Even if they're, you're going, oh, this is a lot. When he explained it to me, I went, okay, I get this.
Yeah.
I get this. So that's important for the jury. They want to hear that someone, not, you know, when they get lost in the terminology, it's like, you know, their minds are wandering. But if they understand it in a simple way, it's going to make a good impression on them.
Yep.
So now—
Was he wearing a white coat also?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if he had the doctor effect, or the lab coat effect, I should say. But so the defense, now, do they have an expert offhand? No, they don't have an expert. Do they wind up having it, or do they wind up with an expert? Yes, but—
How does that happen?
Good question.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover—
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Sally Ginter, and she would wind up as the defense expert.
I have a bachelor's in chemistry from Albion College. Started work as a research chemist at Dow Chemical Company. I worked there for 31 years. During that time, I obtained 23 U.S. patents covering diverse polymers and applications. And in fact, in 1990, I was honored by the U.S. Patent and Trademarks Office for being one of the most prolific female inventors in corporate America. Quite by chance, turned on Court TV and saw that there was going to be a plastics expert, I thought, showing an analysis of the bags that the victim's bodies were found in versus comparing them to some clothing bags. And I thought, well, this will be interesting. It's, you know, technical. It's right up my line. I listened to what he said and the data that he had. And then he concluded that the bags were a match chemically. And not only that, that they must have been made on the same production line within, you know, hours of time. I sent an email to Melanie's lawyers just to tell them that these results that were presented by the state weren't valid, and told him the problems, because I've only saw the graphs, you know, on TV. You couldn't really get into it in depth. It was hard to pick it up on TV. I was merely going by the fact that you couldn't say that they were chemically the same when I called. But once I got the report and saw the report, I was astonished that his own data shows that the bags didn't match. For instance, the two sets of bags in the ASH test, which he said were essentially the same, there was a 39% difference in ASH between the victim bags and the clothing bags, so the victim bags having the most ASH in it. And so there was a huge difference. He said, well, this kind of variation would be typical in a production process, but any process that had a 39% process variation in ASH would be a process that was totally out of control. And the differential scanning calorimeter, all that is a melting point of polyethylene, so that would be expected, so there's nothing unusual about that. Also, on his infrared test, he said that the two curves from both sets of bags superimposed, and they didn't. There was a difference in transmission where they started, and there was some additional peaks in the victim bags that were not in the clothing bags, and so they didn't match either. There's no way of knowing which linear low density polyethylene was in the bag without measuring it. And he has no test that will calculate that. The one attorney called and came to meet me. I think it was between 9 and 10 o'clock. And I went through my report with him. He was rather confused and said that he didn't know that he understood it well enough to be able to question based on this. So he wanted me to break it down into very, very simple terms. And because he said Ruiz's data was very simple and it was easy to understand, and that mine was very complex and not easy to understand, and it was too technical for the jury. So he said, if you can come up with something by 7 o'clock tomorrow morning that is simpler for me to understand, I'll put you on the stand. Couldn't sleep that night, so I'm up most of the night simplifying it all out, writing out what questions that he needs to ask and explaining it in a very simple manner so that he could understand it. I wouldn't call it prepping me there. Most of it was just me trying to talk to him to getting to understand it. I didn't get any prepping. And then I was only allowed to testify based on this report and what I saw. And I was able to make recommendations on what I thought should have been done to show whether they were a match or not, which I did.
Whoa.
Wow. This does a great job illustrating the issue of expert testimony.
Absolutely.
Because
right.
All it takes is someone with confidence that is likable and a jury believes him. I'm not saying whether I believe Frank or not. I don't know. But what I do know is that it's really unfortunate, because a lot of people, I mean, people have been executed that are innocent over, you know, expert testimony.
But there's also then this comes up in appeal again, right? So, you know, they want an expert for this, an expert. And the judge says, you know what, we've had the experts already.
Yeah.
So it's a great point, right? They want another expert. But at what point do you say, There's an expert on this side. This, take two, three, four, stack them.
You could keep going.
You can keep going on and on. But there are a lot of interesting points that come out of Sally. First of all, Sally was watching court TV at home.
Yeah, she has no incentive.
She had a day off.
Right?
Like, she was at home for something.
Very serendipitous, right?
And it is, completely. Yeah. She says, I'm literally, you know, thumbing through the channel, the remote, and I come across court TV and they say, and, you know, a polymer or a plastics expert. And she goes, oh, well, that's weird, you know? So let me just listen because this is my area.
Yeah.
And, you know, according to her, she says she listened to the whole thing and then his conclusion. And she said, no way. You couldn't have made this conclusion. So she contacted Steve Toronto.
Good for her. That's great.
And she said, I mean, I would have asked Steve if he responded to our request for an interview, how many other people contacted him. She said that Steve said, you know, we've gotten a number of phone calls.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, if what was to come of that. But according to Sally, this was like on a Friday. And I think it was Easter weekend.
Wow.
Steve said, can you write a report? And he needed the report in, I don't know if she says it, 48 hours.
Yeah.
Can you write a report about everything on Easter weekend? And by the way, Sally had told me that she was sick during this time as well. So I think she had, it was definitely like 2 days to write this report, have Easter and get better. So she does this. She writes this report.
And what was she getting out of it?
Nothing.
You know, she was
nothing.
She just saw science that wasn't being reported right, and felt like she had to.
She just felt like she had to intervene and she had to say something. And so, yeah, she's offered nothing for this. So
that's
she does. She writes a report. She sends it back after, you know, 2 days. And I don't know how quick the turnaround was, but he says, can you get here and testify? And I think a day or two later, she was on a plane. And what she's describing is that night he came to her hotel and they sat down for a half an hour. And he said, I don't, you know, according to Sally, I don't understand this. The jury won't understand this. If you can't simplify it, forget it. We won't even use you. So she's freaking out. She says, you know, I didn't get a wink of sleep. And Sally has a technical way about her, I have to say. So this, she's explained a couple things to me and then went, all right, let me say this again. And so it is the difference in her, you know, the difference between her and Ruiz as well is he's good at simplifying. He's better at simplifying things, I think. But in fairness, Sally's never testified before, ever. She's never been prepped. And as she says, and I wouldn't consider what, you know, talking to her about it, that's not a prep. Frank Ruiz was prepped.
Yeah.
I asked him about it and he was definitely prepped. Mm-hmm. So there's a real significant difference here in what Sally...
And this was one of the prosecution's main points.
Oh yeah, this was huge.
Yeah.
So Sally goes on the stand and, you know, the test that she's talking about, she commented on the three tests that he said that he ran. And what she said was for, let's see, the first test, the differential scanning calorimetry, she said that his findings were, since they were basically, this would be expected for all the industrial institutional bags since it's governed by, she said, thermal properties of polyethylene. I think it's just standard industry practice.
So like I said, pull any garbage bag and it would be the same.
Yeah. The infrared spectroscopy. Oh, look, I said it that time. She said that Frank Ruiz said that the peaks were the same. And she said, actually, there were differences. They weren't extreme, but she said it wasn't accurate to say that they were exactly the same when they weren't. But the last test, which was this ash test returned about the heating it and burning it down. She says, if you look at his results, you can see significant differences. So we did. What they did too was they did ash tests on the victim bags between those bags to see if there's any variance between the actual bags. And there's a little bit. So what they found when they conducted the ash test just on the victim bags is that between each bag, there's probably 2 to 5% variation, 2 to 6% variation. But then they did the ash test between the victim bags and the bags that were recovered from, you know, Melanie and Bill's apartment. And they found between 22 and 39% difference.
So he just chose not to report on that part?
He said that there was a variation, but it was standard or expected, or it wasn't that big. And she's saying, whoa, hold on. And she made a chart here that I looked at. She's saying, this is not standard. This is huge. This shows those bags were different.
Wow. And maybe we can post those charts on our website.
We're definitely going to post the charts and the findings on our website. So she's saying that the tests, not only are they not enough, but the ones that he did aren't actually supporting what his conclusions are.
But the jury would not know that because they're just lay people.
Well, she said it on the stand, but did she
say
But
I'm saying, had she not...
Yeah, let me... I'll talk about her testimony and the way she expressed it, too, in a little bit. So I also asked her, like, Sally, but what would be needed? How would we know? You know, you're saying this isn't enough. So what do we need? And so Sally explains what tests she thinks would be needed to absolutely conclude that the bags were a match.
No, you could definitely not say that they were chemically the same from the tests that he ran. It would be impossible. These generalized tests, which were basically just kind of quality control tests that you'd run on a bag manufacturing line, couldn't be used to tell if the bags were chemically the same and certainly could not be used to tell if they were produced on the same manufacturing line. The reason that I knew that was because Dow Chemical was one of the largest suppliers in the world, along with Exxon, of polyethylene and linear low-density polyethylene that are used to make the bags. It happens that the linear low-density polyethylene is chemically different if you have the Dow version or if you have the Exxon version. Both of them will process the same, but chemically, they are different. In order to say that the bags were a match, there would be additional analytical tests that would be needed to determine. You would need to do nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy and mass spectrometry, and this would provide definitive results regarding the chemical match of the polymers used to manufacture the bags. Some additional tests would be needed to determine what additives were in the bags, because these could also vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, and these tests would include liquid chromatography and gas chromatography. Later, when I was working with the appeal attorneys, they petitioned the state to get the bags so that we could analyze them chemically, and the state refused. The state would not allow it. He said that my testimony was enough. I said that they didn't match, and so, you know, nothing more was needed.
This is where the judge is limiting and saying, you know what, we've heard from both experts.
He's done hearing about the plastics, it sounds like. The judge doesn't want to hear it anymore.
Well, this was later on for the appeal. Later on in the appeal, the appellate judge is saying, look, you had two experts, like two leaders in the field. What more needed to be done? But Melanie's defense was, even in the appeal, was no, but the right tests weren't done.
She didn't know at the time. At the time of trial, Sally didn't talk about the test that would have needed
to
be done.
She did talk about the test that needed to be done.
But they just didn't have time to do it at that point because it was...
Well, it was, again, it was after the tests had been done by the prosecution. Sally is saying this is what's needed. Frank Ruiz is saying, no, that's not what's needed. So you have two experts battling it out here. Sally's saying, look, I'm sorry, but you cannot say these bags were a chemical match based on the test that he did. The ones he did had some discrepancies, and there were at least two more that she talks about, at least two more tests that she said are absolutely needed to conclude these
bags
were a match.
Maybe they need a tiebreaker expert. I know they don't want to talk to any more experts, but the thing is,
limited on the appeal. They said, forget it.
The thing is, Frank is getting paid. Again, I'm not questioning his integrity.
I understand.
He's incentivized. Sally is not. I don't think that's a point we can gloss over.
I don't think so either, no. And I don't think we can gloss over the fact, again, that Sally had no preparation. So I asked her about testifying a little bit. You know, what was it like? She said, well, God, I was nervous up there, of course. And she said that the prosecutor made her feel, or tried to make, she felt like Patty tried to make her feel like she was small, because she said, well, I'm sorry, where did you go to Albion College? Like some little...
And she only had a bachelor's, right? I know she had tons of years of experience.
Right.
But
so they...
Did Frank have a PhD or...
Frank had...
He must have had some advanced
degree.
He says
it in his qualifications. I'm pretty sure he has a master's, actually. And I think it was did he go to MIT? I mean, he went somewhere, you know, he has a pedigree to him.
But she did work at Dow Pharmaceuticals.
She's definitely, she's a leader. There's no doubt about it. They're both leaders. Yeah. But she said that, you know, she was made to feel small. She said what also flustered her was that when she was talking about these percentages, I think it was in relation to the ASH test, Patty asked her to make a quick calculation. And she said, I couldn't find my calculator. I fumbled. The judge had to give me a calculator. And then when I actually did it, I said, wait a second, that's wrong. And then she redid it. Oh. So she said, I think I looked bad. You know, she looked nervous. She was, I didn't know I was going to have to do some math calculation on the stand here. And it was actually a rather easy calculation, but she just wasn't prepared for it. So she was...
Well, that's why she's such a good prosecutor, right? That's part of.
Yeah, she's, you know, I wouldn't want to go up against her in the courtroom. So there is a second part to the plastics. The state had a forensic scientist as well. His name was Tom Lesniak, and he had looked at some of the forensic science in this case, which there was some, but not strong evidence. There was a dispute over whether or not he should be able to testify about the plastics because that wasn't his area. But I think the judge said, we're going to let him testify about tool mark analysis mm-hmm. because he's qualified in this area. So he does what Sally calls the famous light box experiment.
When I went out to testify, I had no idea or no opinion whatsoever about Melanie McGuire's guilt or innocence. After I came back, a lot of the evidence and testimony was on court TV. So I went through, and when I did that, I saw that Thomas Lesniak had done an experiment. They called it a light box experiment, where he held up garbage bags to show what he called the striations, and he called them the manufacturing characteristics of the bag. And that's, you know, certainly not a standard test with a light box. You know, in terms of the herringbone pattern characteristics that he talked about, it's typical of reprocessed linear low-density polyethylene, and you'd see that on most all industrial and institutional bags. So that finding is not unusual. So he held up this bag, and there was a picture of him in the light shining through the bag. Well, the bags that were the clothing bags were Husky contractor cleanup bags. They're 3 mil bags. They're very, very thick bags. And I thought, well, this doesn't make sense. If he's showing that those are the same, you can't see through a 3 mil bag. And I actually ended up doing the experiment myself and sending it to the appeals lawyers to show them that you can't see through that. But the bag that he used, according to the court TV website, he said that it was a lawn and leaf bag. Well, lawn and leaf bags are quite thin bags. They're usually just a little over a mil, and you can see through those. So the fact that this bag was put up there trying to show these striations that they're talking about, which was really a charade. And I also think that there was huge prosecutorial misconduct. It was blatant and deliberate. Bags don't match. Okay, well, they can take Reese's word for them, I guess, that they match, but we're not sure that they were the same size. And there was also, in the discovery material, there was a meeting where they were discussing the fact that the bags weren't the same size, but then they carefully don't put what size was a discrepancy in there. So there's just enough in there to make you know that they knew, and then they kept checking all those different bag companies trying to come up with a fit. So they just conjured up a case that the bags matched. And they had someone like Louise that was willing to say that. And I really believe, hopefully, that there'll be some justice to this someday. I think if they'd have got a bag expert soon enough, somebody could have done a really, really good, proper job up front. And rather than, you know, me showing up at the last minute, just by chance, it was just a terrible job of defending her by the defense.
Wow, prosecutorial misconduct and poor defense.
Sally says
wow.
it. She says what she thinks. She believes it. She's out there saying, look, she thinks that there were some, she thinks there was intentionally misleading statements, mm-hmm. questions, demonstrations. So this light box experiment that she describes, you know, Lesniak holds up this light box in the garbage bag. So, you know, anyone can do this.
It makes a spectacle, I'm sure. Like she said, a charade, right?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, juries love.
Yeah.
They want to see something,
and,
right?
Yeah.
They like the entertainment. It's like the CSI effect that we talk about in our classes, right?
Yep.
But if you actually look at these bags, as Sally did, like if you look at the contractor bag, if you put it up to the light.
Yeah, and we and did.
We did.
Yeah.
You can barely see through that.
You can't at all.
You really can't. I mean, you really just can't. But when we looked at the lawn and leaf bag that was much thinner,
yep.
you can see the light through it.
You can.
So Sally's saying, you know, this is kind of one of those junk science.
It sounds like grounds for appeal to me, but it's clearly not.
I think it does as well.
But this is also probably the third point that does to me, but...
Okay.
The appellate court obviously is smarter than I am, though. So if they don't think so.
Well, is that, I mean, they're one step in the checks and balance system that we talk about, but aren't we, again, it's up to us to also hold the justice system accountable and over, there has to be oversight, you know, just because they don't want to hear it doesn't mean that it was right. It means that they don't think it's worth hearing.
So, in comparison to other cases as well, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
And I think I have one final point about the garbage bags. As I mean, I could go on and on about these.
Yeah, I'm getting over it.
Yeah, no, I understand. I see. But one thing I want to say is that it seems whenever I reviewed the transcript, the garbage bags, the number of garbage bags tested changes.
Oh.
So, okay. Actually, what I think I found is that some of the garbage bags recovered from the suitcases are missing.
So how many were there?
So
I thought there was only three.
Let me read what... Okay, so the Virginia Forensics Lab logged in a total of 9 bags from 3 suitcases. Virginia analyzed 2 of the bags for fingerprints and notes the presence of a moist film on the bags from the suitcases recovered on May 5th, 2004. New Jersey Forensics Lab logged the receipt of 7 bags from Virginia. Missing are suddenly those 2 bags that were analyzed for fingerprints. And this is part of, this is bait stamped, so it's part of the exhibits. Mm-hmm. Thomas Lesniak testified that 8 victim bags were recovered. Detective Jeffrey Noble stated in his investigation report that 6 bags were recovered.
What?
I have 5 different areas where all the numbers of bags are different. I'm not sure what to say about this.
Yeah.
If we can't get the number of bags straight, I have serious concerns about the actual investigation.
I agree.
But this is what I found. I mean, this is all in the transcript. Whether or not this is an oversight, mistakes made. Again, though, I don't like if it's a mistake. I don't like it either. It strikes
me. Someone's life is on the line here.
It strikes me as a sloppy mistake.
Yeah.
Okay, so I promise you that isn't on the plastics. But there's still one more point about the suitcases and the body. So the plastics was huge, huge, huge. But there were also found, Bill's body parts were also wrapped in plastics and in blankets. So they were HCSC blankets. And these were, I guess, blankets that were distributed to a lot of different medical providers.
Okay.
So I actually did look them up, and it looked like they were a major blanket distributor, and they worked with many medical practices in New Jersey. But they definitely distributed. So these blankets were definitely RMA, Reproductive Medical Associates, where Melanie worked.
Mm-hmm.
They were a client.
How many other clients did they have?
Yeah, they
though?
Had someone testify about the blankets.
A gentleman who worked for a company called HCSC. They're one of the largest distributors of linens for healthcare. And the gentleman was presented with the blanket that was found with Bill's body and said, basically, like, is this one of yours? He said that, you know, RMA was a client, so was the hospital across the street. So are, I think in the tri-state area, they had something like over 100 clients, or on the Eastern Seaboard, I think like 500 clients. But anyway, we were able to elicit on cross that they're not tracked, you know, and the state presented a pair of HCSC scrubs that they had taken from my room at my parents' house. Like, okay, well, here you go. Clearly, this is HCSC stuff. The assumption they want the jury to make at that point is, well, if these scrubs are theirs, the blanket must be theirs as well. What they failed really, I think, to hammer home for the jury is that it was Bill's job to travel to over 100 different healthcare sites in the state of New Jersey. So there are ways that he has of coming into contact with stuff like this, even if they weren't RMAs. You know, they could have been essentially from anywhere. I don't even have a hard time saying that they may very well have come from RMA because, again, I had removed a few of those to wrap the granite inlays of our furniture in. So I always just kind of went with the idea that, yeah, it's ours. Again, there's context. Even when the state put one of my coworkers on the stand, a young lady by the name of Lori Thomas, who had purchased some of my furniture, and of course the young lady they were trying to elicit, you know, smelled like a morgue. I think even she mentioned that she grabbed blankets from work to wrap the furniture in, and they shut that shit down pretty quickly.
So what was Bill's job?
So he worked for New Jersey Institute of Technology, but he was also working, New Jersey Department of Health. He was working for...
I don't think I knew that.
He had 2 jobs at one point. He did have approval, as I understand it, because one was grant funded. But so he did come in contact with medical providers as well.
I think I'm going to say the blankets probably came from RMA. But again, just like the garbage bags, just like the suitcases, if they're in the house, if they're in the car, I don't think she's that stupid. Why are you going to kill your husband and wrap him in blankets from your place of work?
I think it's the same point that we've been making over and over again. Yeah, it's possible. You know, again,
how many blankets? Was there one in each suitcase or several?
I don't know how many blankets there were, you know, but the jury is getting this picture now clearly. Oh, those are her blankets, the plastic bags from the house.
Yeah.
This is all building a really bad, you know, a really bad story, a really bad picture.
Mm-hmm.
There was something else I forgot to read, and this is another request for audience help. When we were talking about the plastics, Sally was doing some research on it. You know, she became involved, obviously, afterwards. She helped with the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And she had found something on a blog, okay, a posting by someone who we tried to find. James and I tried to find him, and we couldn't. So if you are this person, or if you know who this person is, we would certainly appreciate your help. So on July 16th, 2007 at 11:24 a.m., Russ Ferreira posts the following. We worked on this case from the perspective of chemical analysis of the plastic bags and determined that the evidence presented by the state was inconclusive. I'm a graduate of MIT, and we provided data on the melting point and mass spec composition, which could be used to at least conclusively state that from a chemical analysis, one could not absolutely conclude that the plastic was from the same batch. So I don't know who he is. Again, we would love to hear from him. And I would like to know who asked him to do those tests.
Yeah.
Was that the state? Did they ask him, or was this, you know, was this independent? Was it an investigator? So if you are Russ Ferreira, or if you know who Russ Ferreira is, please contact us. We would love to hear from you. All right. Let's wrap on that today. Next time on Direct Appeal, the defense begins their case. They call Bill's ex-wife as a witness. Does she help Melanie's case? Also, the defense calls a critical witness who claims to have had a conversation about a gun with the victim, Bill McGuire. Direct Appeal is hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. The story arc was written by Megan Sachs. Music and underscore by Dessert Media. Recorded, mixed, and edited by Justin Crowell at JC Studios. Special thanks to Alan Tuckerman, whose work was integral to this production. If you have a tip, you can submit through our website or by emailing tips@directappealpodcast.com.